Good evening and welcome to the Fresh Air News Hour. My name is Ollie Lewis, I am Fresh Air's Head of News, and it's a pleasure to be back on air. It's Thursday, it's 6pm, and here's what's coming up before 7. So, in international news today, the war in Ukraine continues. NATO leaders have been meeting in Brussels to discuss what action can further be taken to push back against Vladimir Putin's forces. They've agreed to send a further 40,000 troops to Eastern Europe. Here in the UK, reaction continues to yesterday's spring statement delivered by Rishi Sunak. The 5p cut in fuel duty has already taken effect, but the Chancellor is being criticised for not doing enough to target financial assistance at those hardest hit by the cost of living crisis. But turning to tonight's programme here in Edinburgh, I'm delighted to bring you my interview with broadcaster Ian Dale of LBC. In our extended discussion, we cover some of his favourite interview moments with politicians, why he loves the thrill of breaking news, and why some journalists are choosing to leave the BBC at the moment. All of that coming up later. But before that, we talk to a senior figure behind the most recent strike action at Edinburgh University on his hopes for the ongoing dispute. All that and more before 7. But before all that, I'd like to introduce someone because, you know, it's a pleasure when I'm joined in the studio by guests, and I am joined today by Susanna Siddell, who is a news writer for The Student. Welcome to Fresh Air Radio.
Hiya, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on air. So what we're going to be doing is, after our interview, which I'll introduce in just a moment, with the Vice President of Edinburgh's UCU, University College Union branch, we're going to be having a chat about that and other news that's been going on around Edinburgh in the last few weeks. What would you say is the main story on campus at the moment, the main thing on people's minds? Do you think it is the strikes that have been going on?
I think it's the strikes, but it's definitely, there's been a lot of talk about the protests outside the main library, Gordon Eichmann definitely. So I think there are definitely some things to be said about there.
Absolutely. We'll get into all of that. But first, let's hear that interview. So earlier today, first, just to introduce it, if you are a student at the University of Edinburgh, it is likely that you are, if not only aware, but also have been affected by strikes in recent weeks. These strikes have been organised by the University and College Union on a national scale. And earlier today, I sat down with Vivek Santayana, who is the Vice President of Edinburgh's branch of the University College Union, to discuss the motivations behind the strikes and, you know, the direction of the ongoing dispute. So that's exactly how I started. I started by asking him to summarise the motivations around this latest round of strike action.
There are two major disputes that are currently underway. These are national disputes, and different universities are part of this dispute, depending on whether or not this is something that affects their workplace and pension schemes, depending on whether or not they're pre-92 or post-92 universities. Edinburgh University, being a pre-92 university, is a university that's affected by both disputes.
So the disputes... Just jump in so early, but what does pre-92 mean?
The universities that were established in the year 1992.
Sure, go ahead.
So Edinburgh University, being one of the older universities, is basically embroiled in both these disputes. And these disputes are what is the USS pensions dispute, in which situation, basically, a lot of staff, ranging from senior lecturers, senior professors, to lecturers and early career researchers, all of whom who are employed at the university and have their pensions through the USS, University Superannuation Scheme, pension scheme, are facing losses to their pension. Now, this can vary depending on how much of your pension is affected by these cuts. Lecturers who are much more senior will lose somewhere in the region of 20 to 30% of their pension. People who are much more junior, if you use the pension modeler, particularly the USS own pension modeler, it will show exactly how much your pension stands to change, and members are losing anywhere in the ballpark of 45 to 49% of their pension. Now, this is just the USS pension disputes. Alongside this, there is another, what is called the Four Fights dispute, which is about one core issue that manifests in four different ways. So the issue we're fighting against is the rampant corporatization and marketization of education. This manifests in four ways. Basically, the universities are being run for profit rather than value of education. And as a result of this, staff are massively underpaid. Staff have not had a real terms pay increase in around a decade. On top of this, staff have workloads that are unsustainable and unmanageable. We are being made to do much more than contractually required or obliged. And all of this is being folded into existing terms of our work to the point where we are working far more hours than we could have been previously.
So in terms of the student experience of how we might perceive, you know, that increase in the burden on staff, is that the kind of thing where, you know, it's kind of expected that if I email my lecturer or my tutor at 7 p.m. on a Tuesday evening, I kind of expect them to reply either that evening or very early the next morning? Is it that kind of thing, a kind of expectation that they should always be available? Is that what you mean by casualization, or is there more to it than that?
So there is more to it than that. What you've described is definitely one aspect of this. That is what I meant about workload.
Right.
We have to respond to our students and be made available. Very often it is, you know, responding at short notice, being constantly available to our students. But casualization is, more simply put, about job insecurity. So a lot of academics, especially earlier career researchers, as well as a lot of professional services staff, as archivists, librarians, all of us are working in contracts that are short-term, insecure, hourly paid, and give us no sense of job security and certainty about where we'll be in a few months' time. And that is what casualization specifically is about. It is the increasing use of insecure contracts to make up for what should be full-time, open-ended contracted positions. There is a professor who retired in a school whose teaching burden and research was then split between four or five postdocs on short-term contracts, whereas this was a chaired professor who had been on an open-ended contract. And that's what we mean by casualization.
Right.
So casualization is a third of the four fights. And the last of the four fights is inequality. There is a 15% gender pay gap, and there's an 8% race pay gap, there's an 8% disability pay gap. There are all kinds of injustices in the way staff are paid at this university. Now, all of these issues spiral in together. So what you mentioned in terms of your question about answering answering students' emails, a lot of the teaching that undergraduate students often face are provided by PhD students who are tutors and early career teaching fellows. Now, these are often people who are on hourly paid contracts who do not have the open-ended contract or salaried position that senior lecturers and lecturers have. That means we work by the hour, and there's a cap on the number of hours we can claim for certain tasks. When I used to be a tutor, I was given 2 hours of admin time for the entire semester for all my classes of about 24 students. And that was 2 hours across the semester for answering emails, for drafting the worksheets, for meeting students for essay feedback, for every bit of interaction I'd have with students, even in case...
So you were only paid for 2 hours
of admin
time for the whole semester, yet, of course, the demands that students had expected you to go way beyond that.
It's not just the demands that students had. It is basically the kinds of things we as tutors are morally obliged to provide. For instance, there are some of my students who had complex learning needs who got their diagnosis halfway through the semester. I was given an adjustment schedule by the disability service, but I was given no time to train myself or upskill myself on how to mainstream my students' needs. I had to do this in my own time. And here's what happens when you make tutors do this in their own time. A lot of tutors work second jobs to be able to afford living here, doing their PhD or whatever else. When you force someone to work in their own time, you're taking time away from jobs that they do to pay rent. And that is where this becomes a vicious cycle. And you can see how issues of workload intersect with issues around precarity and insecure contracts.
Sure.
And underpay, and all of these things start snowballing together.
Let's briefly talk about the response of the university. Vice Chancellor Peter Matheson and the senior team, obviously they have said that they disapprove of strike action in recent weeks and indeed recent years. The argument that they make is that this is a national issue. You know, you talk about the profitization of education. They would argue, some people would argue, that that stems from central government and the way that universities are funded on a national level. Do you buy the argument that actually there is very little that Edinburgh University itself can do to meet the demands of the UCU?
Absolutely not. There are a number of smoke screens that the senior management team has thrown in front of us. At a Q&A that we had with Peter Matheson a few years ago when I was a PhD student, we posed this precise question. I asked, as a PhD student and as a tutor, why the university was not negotiating on this. Peter Matheson's response was that the university does what the USS trustees instructed to do in terms of the pension contributions. The USS trustees earlier this year had said that the UCU's compromise proposal was well-costed and easily implementable, and advised UUK, the university's representative in the pensions dispute, to implement them. Edinburgh University and all the universities voted against this in their consultation. So whilst these are national disputes, the national disputes are between the representatives of all vice-chancellors and universities, of which our university is a very big and influential member. We're a Russell Group university. We're one of the largest universities in the UK. We're the largest university in Scotland. Peter Mattison disguises how much clout and influence Edinburgh University has in this dispute and hides behind this smokescreen of it being a national dispute. What we're calling for is our university to lobby UUK in the pension dispute and lobby UCEA, which is the employer's representative in the Four Fights dispute, to basically negotiate and adopt the position, the compromise position that the UCU has put forward. And in all honesty, we are a very powerful university. And I think it behooves our management to take the moral high ground here and adopt a more progressive position, because they have the means to do this. They have over £100 million surplus. They have the resources to do this. They have the clout to do this. And above all, we are the city of the enlightened. I think it's incumbent upon Edinburgh University to take such an enlightened view.
Sure. What do you say about the response of students? What's the response that you've seen on campus in the last few weeks from students as they've walked past picket lines, students you might have spoken to? Do you sense a feeling of support generally for the strike, or at least the aims of the strike?
So, you know, there are different cross-sections of students. And yeah. I know that there are a lot of students who really don't support the strikes and feel their education has been disrupted. And I fully appreciate that. But, you know, the point is, yes, their education is being disrupted, but the disruption is not coming from the staff. The disruption is coming further upstream, because the staff are going on strike because we cannot tolerate the conditions in which we're working. And we're just no longer willing to be thrown under the bus by management just to absorb the impact of management's of the leadership's mismanagement of the university from impacting students. But then there are also a lot of students who learned about the strikes and became more informed. And when we told them about what the issue was, and to be honest, when we explained what casualization meant in simpler language, because let's be honest, that's not the clearest measure to get across, a lot of students understood that students themselves are fighting for the same things. You know, our students are working multiple part-time jobs to be able to afford rent and to live here. And we're all on the same side. And university management is exploiting us the same way it's exploiting students. You know, fun fact, the university has cut its grants to USA at the same time when it's cutting the pay for staff. There's a lot to be said
USA
about how the university
student
doesn't
union,
care.
Of course. Yeah, yeah. Of
Absolutely.
Course.
But in on top of this, there have been a lot of students who have been very vocal about their support. And students have occupied the Gordon Eichmann Lecture Theatre in solidarity. The Staff Student Solidarity Network is buzzing with activity and energy. It's great to see that on top of all of this, there are always a lot of students who are supporting the staff going on strike and willing to reach out and talk to other students as well, to explain to other students how we're all fighting on the same side. And, you know, one thing we often forget, a lot of members of UCU are students. We have PhD students, postgraduate, like research and taught students who are members. So we are genuinely in the same fight.
I'm just keen to get a sense of, I've been at university, this is my third year at university, I've experienced a lot of strike action. And I'm just wondering, is there anything beyond strike action that the UCU thinks might be possible to try and shift? Because it seems like this is a dispute that is never going to be resolved. It seems extremely static. It seems like we're in a bit of a stalemate. And it seems like strike after strike comes around and nothing ever changes. Is there anything else that you can use to try and, you know, advance your position in this dispute?
That's actually a good point. I mean, I don't think it's entirely true that nothing ever changes. There have been incremental gains that we've made, and I know this looks like a stalemate just now because the tactic that UUK are using is to wait out the strikes, but we have made progress in these disputes in terms of securing a compromise position that UUK itself found workable and stuff. So, you know, things do change. But in terms of your broader question about what it is that, you know, what other alternative strategies we can try. Now, as a trade union, there are only certain legally sort of there are only certain routes that we can use as tools in a trade union dispute. But in addition, there are some strategies we are considering in terms of marking boycotts and other forms of disruption that are targeting management specifically in terms of management's administration rather than the delivering of teaching. There are nuances there because there are devils in the detail in terms of marking boycotts that could disproportionately affect students, particularly international students whose visa status might come under pressure if they're unable to demonstrate progression between years. So we're still working out what the most effective strategy would be so that we don't harm our students, because our quarrel is not with our students. Our quarrel is with the management.
And what you mentioned, marking boycotts, obviously that's something that students would find quite shocking. And I guess the whole point of industrial action is to try and make people kick up a fuss to those in power. And so it's, you know, no one enjoys strike action, but students, when strikes happen, get to sit back, focus on their studies whilst staff are on strike. A marking boycott, however, that would change the dynamics of students teaching completely. They would be putting in all this work that would then go unmarked. I see that, you know, from speaking to students, fellow students, that would be huge, and that would cause a lot of uproar among students. Is there any potential of that happening in the near future, do you think?
So that's what we're discussing right now. So the thing about marking boycott is it's actually a lot more complex than a lot of people realize. And to be honest, even this is stuff that I learned earlier this morning speaking to some of my colleagues who were telling me that the way marking works in this university is incredibly complex. There's so many layers to it. The first layer is obviously the tutors doing the marking for the essays. But then after that, the marks need to be moderated and ratified and then submitted to exam boards. And there are several layers in this process that have multiple points of failure that we could be targeting. And yes, you know, to imagine a lot of students putting in a lot of work that might go unmarked is profoundly disruptive. But there we are discussing what the best strategy for a marking boycott would be, whether or not we should, you know, at what point in this pipeline of marking should we target our disruption? And, you know, those are questions which none of us have the answer to, because this is a new strategy. We've not tried it before. So we're still trying to consult our membership and see what the best strategy is. But like you said, a disruption like a marking boycott would be something that would cause a massive uproar. And we want to make sure that we can deliver the best kind of feedback and support and education to our students whilst disrupting what marking represents to the higher pipeline in terms of the management and administration of the university. We do want our students to get feedback and support on their work. We do want our students to improve their writing and have their and have feedback on their learning. But at the same time, there could be ways where we can disrupt the administration of the university and the way the senior administration of the university manages the assessments towards the end of the year.
Very interesting. Just finally, very briefly, what is your broad message to Peter Matheson specifically on the issue of striking and the pay dispute at the moment, the pension dispute?
So my broad message to Peter Matheson is very simple. You know, Edinburgh University is based in the city of the Scottish Enlightenment, and we want Peter Matheson and Edinburgh University to take the enlightened position, show leadership amongst all the other Russell Group universities and Scottish universities, and implement the UCU's compromise position, lobby UUK to implement those positions, and negotiate through UCEA to stamp out casualization, the pay inequalities, and all the other injustices in higher education.
Vivek Santayana, thank you so much for joining us on the Fresh Air News Hour. It's been great speaking to you.
No worries. Thank you for having me, Ollie.
So that was my interview with the Vice President of Edinburgh's UCU. Really, really interesting, I thought. So to talk about that and more, as I said at the start, I'm very delighted to be joined by Susanna Siddell. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's lovely.
So we heard that interview from Vivek talking about the motivations for the strikes, what possible action could come in the future if this latest round of strikes don't resolve the dispute. What's your take on the action that's been going on in the last few weeks? Because it really has been a big disruption. We're both politics students. It's been a big disruption. What's your view on the whole situation?
Well, I'm definitely 100% supporting the teachers. I believe that, you know, there are educators. Mm-hmm. They deserve fair treatment. And the University of Edinburgh is not providing exactly what they need. And I think they definitely have a duty in, you know, listening to their employees and responding accordingly, definitely.
Yeah. And what do you say to students who are really frustrated about the strikes and, you know, they see this as simply a disruption to their education, and that if they're not from Scotland, they're paying a very large amount of money for their education. And if they've been here for a few years, they've seen the strike action come and go many times. What would you say to their frustrations?
I definitely understand those frustrations. I mean, I feel like, you know, the strikers have done what they like have wanted. They have created disruptions. However, I think it's, you know, I think the students need to just have a bit more understanding.
Yeah, yeah. Understanding of why the strikes are going ahead.
Yeah, yeah. 100%. It's a hard thing to get your head around, especially when it's affecting your education and on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. However, you know, it's definitely a thing that, you know, people need to take into consideration, and you know, it's learning about life beyond university. You know, university is not just students, it's the teachers too.
Yeah, interesting. So in addition to the strikes in the last few days, something that I've really noticed being on campus in George Square is that there have been a number of student protests that seem to be interlinked with but not directly related to the strikes. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, no, I think it's great. I mean, it's the students getting involved, like involving themselves politically and raising awareness.
What kind of issues have they been talking about that you've heard?
I mean, you've got the obviously the UCU strikes, and then yeah. You've got the climate change activists, as well as the Israeli-Palestinian raising awareness about that conflict, which I think is very important, especially this week. Yeah, no, I think they're all worthy causes. I get slightly concerned that maybe they, like, their voices get
drowned out
yeah. by each other, because obviously a lot of powerful voices, I worry that they're just going to be like blended together and no one's really going to take.
You mean voices within this student movement? You mean are they talking about too many issues? Is that what you think? Or
I think they're all like worthy issues that sure. need voices. However, putting them all in one sort of area, I worry that, again, they get drowned out by each other and then no one's really listening.
Yeah, it takes the sting out of what they're saying, potentially.
Yeah.
The occupation of Gordon Eichmann, which for those listening who are not familiar with University of Edinburgh's campus, is one of the biggest lecture theatres on campus in the middle of George Square in the heart of Edinburgh. Do you know much about what that occupation is doing? Because it's more than kind of a protest. It seems to be an organised almost festival. There seem to be events going on in there. Have you been along? Do you know much about what's going on in there?
I have walked past it multiple right. times. Yeah, yeah. And I've kind of wanted to put my head in, but I haven't quite done that yet. But it always seems very, very busy. You're right, there's always something happening.
Yeah, yeah. But is that organised by the same people who are organising the vocal protests outside the library? It seems...
That's the thing, like, it's not exactly clear right. about who's who.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And again, they're all worthy causes. However, if I can't identify which one's which, it's not. I don't think that's exactly their goal.
Yeah, right, okay. Towards the end of that interview, Vivek Santayana spoke about the potential for a marking boycott as... if you like, a step further than a strike, that would be academic staff literally refusing to mark assignments that they'd been given, not just for a period of time, but indefinitely for a semester. That could go one of two ways with students, couldn't it? That could either galvanise students to get incredibly angry at the university,
absolutely.
Submit letters en masse to Peter Matheson, and potentially play a role in resolving this dispute, or that anger could be directed directly at the academic staff, don't you think? Do you have any sense of where that anger would go?
I think, unfortunately, it would go towards the academic staff, because
right.
the thing is, one of the outside Gordon Eichmann, there's a poster that says something along the lines of, like, for a better university, mm-hmm. or something along those lines.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's incredibly positive and very, very hopeful, but unfortunately I don't think that's the reality. And so I don't think writing to Peter Matheson is really going to gain a reaction that we'd hope for. I think it would just cause an increase of tension between students and staff. And, you know, loads of the staff don't want to hurt their students' educations. Mm. I know they're absolutely doing their best. However, I don't think it would create
It wouldn't quite achieve what they hoped. Okay, yeah, because I do have to say, I think I agree that there would certainly be a huge amount of anger if academic staff decided not to mark assignments that they were given. My hunch is that generally that anger would go towards the people who directly on the surface might seem responsible for that, which would be academic staff. Obviously, the academic staff would say, well, hang on, this is part of industrial action to force the university to make a change. But I think you're right. Yeah, interesting. Do you foresee potentially more industrial action this semester? It's potentially unlikely, given that we're coming towards the end of it and that therefore we're probably looking more towards next year. But if this dispute doesn't get resolved, we're probably looking at more strike action from September, aren't we?
Yeah, I definitely think so, about October, November time. Yeah. And then again in semester two. Yes. I just think it will be ever present in our
it's
lives.
It's becoming a biannual tradition at Absolutely. The University of Edinburgh and at many other universities across the country. Susanna Siddell, thank you so much for joining us on the Fresh Air News Hour. It's been really interesting. And yeah, please come back soon.
Thank you very, very much for having me.
Thank you. Now, next on the Fresh Air News Hour, I'm extremely excited to introduce an interview that I have done in recent weeks with Ian Dale. Now, Ian is a broadcaster, very well known. He presents the evening show on LBC Radio, Leading Britain's Conversation. He has had the privilege of interviewing prime ministers, presidents. He hosts a weekly, a nightly show, a panel show called Cross Question on his LBC show. And so he has a wealth of experience, not just in broadcasting, but in politics and in campaigning as well. It is an absolute treat. We cover all kinds of things, his favourite interviews, his advice to young journalists, that kind of thing. And it's rather funny as well. It's a really nice listen, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did recording it. So this is my sit down with Ian Dale. And I'm delighted to say that right now we are joined by Ian Dale on Fresh Air Radio, broadcaster and writer. Ian, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. It's very kind of you.
Not at all. Looking forward to it.
Wonderful. So I'd like to start, if I may, about talking about news coverage right now at the moment. And by that, of course, I mean coverage of Ukraine. There are some stories in news media that just require blanket coverage, aren't they? Aren't they? Just by dint of their scale and significance. And Ukraine is obviously one of them. And I'm interested, because you're now dedicating virtually the whole of every programme on LBC to Ukraine. Do you struggle to find, you know, new, unique, creative ways of covering the same story from different angles every single night? Or do you think because the scale of the story, there's just so much to talk about?
I think more the latter at the moment. Yeah. The invasion happened, nearly 2 weeks ago now. You're right, every single programme since then. And I've done some weekend shows, so that's probably 11 programmes, 3 hours, yeah, mainly devoted to Ukraine. Cross Question, which comes in the middle of my programme. Virtually all the questions have been on Ukraine for that. Not all, but virtually all. Mm-hmm. And in a way, you have to respond to the public. We are, as broadcasters, led by what the public want. And we know that if the public are getting tired of it, because the phone calls dry up, they really haven't dried up on this. And there are lots and lots of different new angles. And I can't say so far that I've ever gone into the newsroom and thought, oh, God, which bit of it should we do today? It's relatively obvious what we should do. And we do try and create new angles. For example, last Thursday, I did an hour on what I've called war anxiety, the mental health consequences of this, because a lot of people are feeling really anxious in this country I'm talking about, not necessarily in Ukraine. And when you hear talk of nuclear war, people do get very frightened. So we did an hour on that, which was actually bizarrely quite uplifting in a way. I remember three of the female callers that we had, I ended up having a real laugh with them at the end of the calls, which you don't normally do on a mental health phone-in. So that was something different. We've also done one or two Q&As with experts, which I think people, I mean, look, I don't know if you knew much about Ukraine before this, but I certainly didn't.
No, I didn't.
A lot of people have, sorry, it's my dog. A lot of people have lots of questions, which maybe they are afraid to ask because they might think they might look stupid. Mm. So last Thursday, we got Michael Clark, former Director General of the Royal United Services Institute, Ben Judah, who's written a book on Putin. He was live from New York. And we spent an hour taking questions. And I had an email from somebody who said, In my 71 years on this earth, that is the best hour of radio I've ever heard, which I thought was quite a nice compliment. And then on Saturday, I was doing the Saturday morning show because Matt Fry, who normally does that, he's in Ukraine.
In Ukraine,
and we did an hour with Bill Browder, the anti-corruption activist. And again, it was just amazing. The questions that came in, all super intelligent questions. It was just a real pleasure to host. So, I mean, you can always do, should we be taking more refugees? Should we be imposing a no-fly zone? Those have been obviously two of the main subjects, but you are always looking to do something a little bit different.
Yeah, and would you agree that I think phone-in radio is sometimes looked at from quite a snobby point of view in this country. You know, I wouldn't want to attribute that to a particular, you know, another station, people from another station saying that. But, you know, there is a view sometimes that phone-in radio is, you know, slightly easier, slightly less serious.
You mean people who listen to Radio 4 say
Well,
that.
I that's didn't say you said
no,
it.
No, I know you didn't, but that's what you meant.
some people think that phone-in radio is slightly more, you know, less serious, let's say. But actually, I found in the last few weeks listening to LBC that it is at times like this where it really comes into its own, because you don't hear the views of, you know, fascinating people who have sometimes hugely unique perspectives on some of the events.
Well, let me give you an example on that. When this all really started boiling up about 3 weeks ago, maybe 4 weeks ago, I think it was the first phone-in I did on Ukraine, and a guy called Tom in Brighton phoned in, and he just I thought he was going to be not a very good caller when he started, because he seemed to be quite nervous. Mm-hmm. But once he got into his stride, he gave us a sort of, I don't know, 8-minute potted history of Ukraine, because he'd worked in Moscow. His wife was Ukrainian. His ex-wife was Ukrainian. And I basically didn't say anything for 8 minutes, which, if you've listened to my program, is not the norm.
Yeah.
And I had so many texts and emails and tweets afterwards saying, oh, my God, that was fascinating. We want to hear more. So I rang him up after the program and I said, would you like to do a podcast on the history of Ukraine? So we did that, did about 40 minutes, put it up, and it got thousands of downloads. And you just never know what the next call is going to be. And yes, look, you get idiots phoning in. I mean, I won't deny that. But generally, if the host of the show sets the parameters properly, you can get some cracking calls and calls that actually tell you more than if you had a reporter on the scene. I know that sounds weird, but sometimes ordinary callers who've got a unique perspective on a particular story, they can give you something that a reporter never can. And particularly when you're talking about emotional subjects like depression, grief, things like that, people have got their own stories, and you don't need to have sort of dozens of people phoning in. You need 4 or 5 people with good stories. You let them tell their story. So it's not a sort of 90-second phone call. It can be 4, 5, 6 minutes, even longer. I mean, I have done half an hour once before when they've been absolutely superb. Because in a way, as my boss or my ex-boss used to always say, we're not a music station, but our callers are our hit records. And he was, I mean, it sounds a sort of David Brent thing to say in some ways, but it's absolutely bang on.
Yeah, it is. I remember must have been during the pandemic, I think you did an hour-long phone-in on victims of male rape or something, which is something I just have never heard covered on commercial or you know, national radio, and it was a fantastic hour. As you say, you're not talking about hundreds of callers, you're talking about a few incredible.
Well, it's funny because we did get hundreds of callers on that. Oh, really? And I remember when I first suggested to my producers that we do this, they looked at me as if I was mad, because, and I knew what they were thinking. They're thinking, who is going to phone in to talk about being raped, particularly if you're a bloke? And I said, just trust me. And within 5 minutes, full switchboard. I mean, we literally had hundreds of calls that hour. And it was the sort of thing where I wish we had another hour and we could have carried it on. Because often on phone-ins like that, and particularly on mental health, people often think that they're the only ones that are experiencing what they're experiencing. And of course, what those kind of phone-ins, they tell people that they're not the only one. And it's an enormous relief in a way, I think. And I think it encourages people to maybe get some help if they need it. I mean, not everyone does. And also, if you've got yourself as a presenter an angle to this where you've experienced something, you should bring that in. There are some presenters who just view themselves as the sort of conduit. Whereas I think, look, I mean, I always remember one of the first things I was told when I started at LBC was, give of yourself.
Yeah.
But I mean, I had an experience once where that nearly happened to me. And so I related that on the radio as a way of encouraging people to phone in and tell their stories. And believe me, it worked.
Yeah. Yeah. You talk about, you know, setting the parameters of the program. And this is a question more for me as well as my audience. But I'm aware that a lot of the producers that you work with are considerably younger than you. And so what is that relationship like? Who controls the direction of the programme? You come into the office and you say, right, these are the stories in the news. Obviously, the producers have, you know, their remit partially is the direction and the content of the programme. But obviously, you're also a presenter who's been in this business for a very long time. How does that relationship work and that conversation go on a daily basis?
Well, you're right. I'm very old, so inevitably the producers are
going
to
say something like that.
Walked into that. I think, I mean, the oldest producer I've had, I think, has probably been about 34. Hmm. My two producers at the moment, one is 29 and one is 23. And in a way, there has to be this relationship of mutual trust.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some subjects or some, I mean, for example, if a comedian dies who was really famous in the 1970s, they will have never heard of him or her, generally him. Mm. And I just have to say, trust me on this one. Our audience will know who this is. We need to do a sort of little obit thing. Yeah. So there is a sort of, it's sort of, they live by different cultural memories than I do. Mm. So there's that. I mean, in the end, I'm the editor of the program. It's my decision ultimately as to what goes out and what we do. But I can't really ever remember having to sort of say, I don't care what you think, we're doing it my way. The relationship, if you have to do that, it would generally mean that the relationship doesn't work very well. It's always, and sometimes when we've got four or five different subjects we could do for a phone, and sometimes I'll just say, oh, you decide. Mm-hmm. But it's generally a decision that we make. And because I broadcast my program from a different studio now at 4 Millbank, which is opposite the House of Commons, on Thursdays I'm in Leicester Square, but Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I'm not actually in the newsroom. So it's all done by telephone. And they normally come up with some suggestions. We then have a chat at about, I don't know, 3 o'clock maybe, make the decisions, and then I basically leave them to it. If I've got suggestions for guests, or if I've got a contact for a guest, I will ring them up to us to come on the program. But generally, they do that, all the legwork. And because I completely trust them, I don't really interfere. And so when I get into the Millbank up to now it's been at 6, but of course Andrew Marr's starting today. Yeah. So he's got the studio, so God knows how I'm going to work. But yeah. I get in there, I write my 6:59 talk up, we pre-record that. I might do a pre-recorded, because we do cross-question Monday to Wednesday, the 7:45 to 8:00 section of the programme is always pre-recorded, so we have time to get the guests into the studio. So I might do a pre-record for that. So it's all quite smooth, but then of course you can be thrown completely off course when at 5 to 7, there's a breaking news story, and you think, okay, let's scrap everything. And I love that. I mean, breaking news is kind of what I live for, because the adrenaline flows. It's just great.
Are there any particular memories of covering breaking news on LBC that just stand out as, you know, phenomenally exciting?
I mean, it's a horrible thing to say, but I love covering terror attacks. I mean, I would never want there to be one, just course. So I can cover
from
it.
From a
journalistic point of view, you want to be on air when something big is happening.
Because people are coming to you for that.
Yeah, and they do come to us because they know what we will be doing.
Yeah.
If they go to 5 Live, they might be covering Wimbledon or some sporting event.
Yeah.
Radio 4 very rarely break into their schedules for a news story. So we are the one place that people know that we'll be on it for however long it takes. And I mean, the one that I suppose sticks most in my mind was nearly 9 years ago now. I just started doing the Drive Time program. Mm-hmm. And just before we came on air, we heard reports of some sort of vicious attack in Woolwich. And it turned out to be the terrorist murder of Lee Rigby.
Yeah.
Now, that was at about 3:30, I think I first heard of that. So I was going on there at 4. 5 to 4, And we knew by this stage that someone had been killed. We didn't know the horrific circumstances. And I saw my producer, Matt, who he was on the phone. I was thinking, why is he on the phone? Why isn't he telling me what I ought to be doing? Because I had no clue what I was supposed to say when I went on air at 4:05. And he just sort of motioned to me, it's going to be okay. So I worked out he was speaking to somebody. And I had tweeted about 3:30, if anybody saw anything, get in touch.
Yeah.
Well, he was talking to a guy called James who had been standing 3 yards away when it happened. Wow. And he happened to follow me on Twitter. And so he then came on the program at 4:05. He told me all that happened. And it was quite horrific detail, which you have to remember, at 4:05, mothers are still picking their kids up from school. They've got kids in the car, listening to the radio. And then they hear this guy saying, and then he chopped his head off.
Yeah.
Now, there are Ofcom regulations about that sort of thing. So I had to sort of quickly think, should we be doing this? And then I thought, you know what? Sod it. People need to know the horrific nature of this. So just carried on. Anyway, talked to him for about 10 minutes. And that was it. That set the whole program up, really. Mm-hmm. And I was on air for 4 hours that night, just doing this, nothing else at all. And it was, I think that was the moment when at the end of the program, I thought, you know what, I can do this.
Right.
Because I'd had no journalistic or broadcasting training. Mm. I was flying by the seat of my pants for the first 2 or 3 years. And I mean, I quite enjoy that sensation in many ways. But there is a potential for saying something that really will come back to haunt your whole career. Yeah. But that evening, I did think to myself afterwards, we did a bloody good job there. And we did, which was acknowledged by the BBC when they held an inquiry as to why their coverage was so awful.
Oh, really?
And they kept playing bits from our coverage to teach their people on what they ought to have been doing.
Wow.
So
that is a compliment, yeah.
It really was. And that's where we're so nimble, in that we only have... If I want to do something, I mean, whether it's on a breaking news story or whether it's just a normal program, if it's something that's remotely controversial, I only have one person I need to go to say, yeah, this is what I want to do. Are you okay with this? And the BBC, you can imagine the layers of bureaucracy that they have to go through.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the reason why LBC is now attracting people like Eddie Mayer, Andrew Marr, John Sopel, Emily Maitlis, because they are fed up with all the constraints to their broadcasting. So, I mean, LBC is a great place to be.
Yeah, well, you absolutely anticipated my next question. And because I was going to ask, on the day that we're recording this, Andrew Marr is beginning his programme on LBC. It was announced last week. John Sopel and Emily Maitlis will be joining the station. So you do think that one of the main attractions of LBC over a place like the BBC right now is that people... Do you think people are fed up of the impartiality model? Or do you think it's more than that? It's more kind of... systemic and bureaucratic than that?
I think it's both in a way. I think more the latter than the former,
right,
in some ways. I mean, take Eddie Mayer as an example. Mm-hmm. I think he had, well, I mean, I haven't actually talked to him ever about his motivation for joining LBC, but I imagine it was that he wanted to be able to do things that maybe he wasn't allowed to do at the BBC. But on the other hand, he hasn't really become particularly opinionated.
No, he hasn't.
And I mean, Sheila Fogarty, when she came over, I think it took her probably 2 years, and she said this on a podcast I did with her recently, 2 years to really adapt to LBC and to discover that, oh yes, she did have opinions.
Yeah.
And boy, she expressed them. And Andrew Marr, I think, is going to be fascinating, because I think he said it in various interviews before he started, that he wants to get his voice back. And I mean, I know, if I say, for example, if I got an offer to go to the BBC today, whether it's 5 Live or Radio 4, I think I would turn, well, I suppose it depends what it is. If you want to be lead presenter of the Today programme, I suppose you'd be stupid to turn it down. Yeah. But they're never going to offer me that. But I couldn't do what I do on the BBC.
No.
I couldn't just be scripted all the time. That's just not me. Everyone thinks I must have a script that I operate from. I have in front of me at 7 o'clock, a blank piece of paper, and I don't have any script whatsoever. When I go into an interview, I might have 4 or 5 bullet points of areas that I want to cover with somebody, if it's a really important politician, but I'll never have scripted questions. Mm-hmm. Because if you have scripted questions, you then ask those scripted questions, and it's not a conversation. And I think I get the better interviews when I have a conversation with somebody rather than just going for the jugular right at the beginning. So I think it is the sort of freedom that LBC gives you. We don't have anybody saying to us, we want you to take this kind of angle. I mean, Twitter always assumes that there is an LBC corporate line. There is absolutely not. We have presenters from across the political spectrum. Yeah. And we're encouraged to give our opinions. We're never told what our opinions should be. And if we ever were, I think that would be the day that I would quit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's hugely interesting seeing the contrast between presenters on LBC. I'm wondering from, because obviously a lot of students will be listening to this. This is student radio. And I myself, I'm a student journalist wanting to get into the industry. Do you think that the model of impartiality, balance, not being able to give your opinion on a lot of, from a lot of publications or on a lot of stations, do you think that should be a concern for people like me and for students wanting to get into the industry? Because I often find myself on my radio show sitting there thinking, should I be having a rant about this or expressing that opinion, because that could come back to haunt me in a job interview in 5 years' time when an employer points to that and says, well, if people know you think that, then you can't work for us. It's quite a hard act to balance, isn't it?
I think it depends who you're broadcasting for.
Yeah.
I mean, impartiality for the state broadcaster, I think, is actually quite an important thing. Mm. But what does impartiality mean? Does it mean if you say one thing, you have to say, but of course, some other people say this? Well, that's what you do on the BBC.
Yeah.
I think that's the borders of that are being stretched at the moment, where you look at, for example, Stephen Nolan on Five Live, who is one of the best broadcasters in the business, I think. I've learned so much from him. I mean, he has opinions and he expresses them, but he knows where the borders are. Nicky Campbell is a little bit the same as well. And I just think if you're a radio phone-in host and all you're doing is say, well, let's go to Beth in Woodford Green. Okay, thanks, Beth. Let's go to Jim in Lewisham. Okay, I mean, how boring is that? You've got to surely insert yourself somehow into that conversation and encourage people to phone in and maybe provoke people a little bit. And there will be some times when I just play devil's advocate where I will say something that I actually don't believe. I mean, for example, if I interview somebody, often I get it in the neck for saying, I can't believe Ian Dale thinks that. And they only think I think that because I've asked a question of the interviewee just to play devil's advocate. I might be, privately, I might be agreeing with the interviewee. But everyone wants to pigeonhole you, and there are no shades of grey here. It's black or white. You believe one thing or another. There can't possibly be a middle way. And in a way, I don't like that in the way that our national conversation has developed. But I don't think there's any way of going back on that.
How important do you think it is to be, I'm guessing you think it's important to be self-aware as a broadcaster and a journalist. But if you take the art of the interview, for example, you are a fantastic interviewer, in my opinion, but you have a very different style from someone like Andrew Neil or Emily Maitlis, who are perhaps more confrontational, more, you know, they clearly prep for interviews with sheets and sheets of statistics and almost to lay traps for politicians. And there is definitely, you know, a market for that, especially at election time. But I get the sense that the way you like to, you know, demonstrate what people think is to try and get into their heads, understand them as people more.
Well, that's actually a very perceptive question because, of course, I used to be on the other side of this. I used to be in politics. So I think in some ways, because I know how they think, because if I'm watching Question Time on the BBC, I will always think, oh God, how would I answer that question? And of course, sometimes you think, oh God, I wouldn't know what to say. But of course, when you're on it, I've done it a couple of times, the adrenaline flows and you do come up with some sort of answer.
Yeah.
But maybe I can get inside their heads a little bit, but I don't go into an interview thinking I'm going to do you over, which I think some interviewers do.
Think that anyone that you've ever thought, right, they need exposing or that kind of, has anyone tempted you like that?
I mean, in 12 years, I guess there must have been, but I can't readily think of anybody. I mean, even people like John McDonnell, who in essence I have little in common with in belief terms. I get newslines out of John McDonnell because I don't adopt a confrontational air with him, we have a conversation, mm-hmm. and I quite like him. And sometimes you think, well, just because you like someone, then you see, people think, because I don't generally shout at an interviewee or I'm not gratuitously rude to them, therefore I must be a soft interviewer. Mm. Now, David Frost, who I think was one of the greatest interviewers of all time, everyone thought that he was a soft interviewer because he would lull people into a false sense of security, but he would always get the news lines. And I find that if I'm doing a half-hour interview, by minute 22, the producer's getting a bit nervous because they think, oh, this is a bit of a cozy chat. Where's the news line here? And invariably, the news line comes in minute 27 when they're perfectly comfortable. They've trotted out all of the sound bites that they had pre-prepared. And after sort of the first 10 minutes, they have to say something original because generally they don't do interviews for more than 10 minutes, so they're not used to it. And I mean, Theresa May, I remember doing an interview with her once, getting absolutely nowhere. She is an incredibly difficult person to interview. And sure enough, minute 27, I get the news line. And sometimes it is generally not prepared. Obviously, you know the subject that you're talking about, but you have to be aware that the person you're interviewing probably knows more about it than you do. And I remember interviewing Theresa May. This was just after her disastrous conference speech in 2017. Yeah. And I thought she would cancel because I'd been trying to get her to do a phone-in with me for 18 months. So they'd set it up for the week after the party conference. Anyway, she turns up and she's not a natural phone-in person. But she was doing quite well. She answered a couple of questions really well. And then we had a lady from Italy wanting to ask about her rights after Brexit. Mm-hmm. And she gave an answer which was entirely unempathetic to this woman. So I then intervened and I ended up asking her, if there was a second referendum, Prime Minister, how would you vote in that referendum? And she went to pieces. She had no answer. And she just said, well, it's a hypothetical question. I said, well, it isn't really, is it? Because there's a big movement for one. You voted Remain, and yet you're leading a Brexit government. I think the public would quite like to know how their prime minister would vote in this. But I did it in a very calm, non-confrontational way. And again, she gave a non-answer. And I said, well, I don't really understand why you can't answer this, because Jeremy Hunt answered it last week when I asked him the same question. He said he had voted Remain and he would now vote Leave. Why can't you do the same, Prime Minister? Now, her advisors were furious, and I knew that I would never interview her again after that. I knew that I'd done the right thing.
Yeah.
And that interview, I mean, it went everywhere. And Andrew Neil on This Week, he said every Conservative politician is now going to be asked the Ian Dale question. And I thought, my mission is complete. My life's work is done. I've got a compliment from Andrew Neil, who I think is a fantastic interviewer. But the thing is, you know, everybody has a different style. And if you try and become something that you're not, and if I try to become a shouty, rude interviewer, it doesn't work.
No.
And I mean, I have done interviews where if I think someone's lying to me or deliberately trying to pull the wool over my eyes, yeah, I'll mix it with the best of them. But I don't automatically go into an interview thinking that's how it should be done.
And so that was the first part of my interview with broadcaster Ian Dale. Thank you so much, Ian, for giving us that interview. It was an absolutely fascinating chat, but that's not all of it. I'm afraid we have run out of time on today's programme, but if you'd like to hear the full version of that, it will be up on our podcast feed this evening or tomorrow, and Ian goes on to talk about what it's like to interview Boris Johnson, which is obviously something that we'd all like to know about, and any advice that he has for young journalists, which is potentially something that appeals to a lot of you. As I say, that is unfortunately all we have time for. Thank you so much for joining me on the Fresh Air News Hour this evening. I won't be back this time next week because deadline season is very much upon us. I'll be back for our final show of the semester on the 7th of April. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'll see you on the 7th of April. In the meantime, stay well. Good evening.